Thank you so much, Dan and Annie Laurie. It's a great honor to speak to this group. And in fact, I really don't have any right to be speaking to you here tonight. I'm really a parasite. I really intended to be in the audience for the award to be given to Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein. But when I had the opportunity to do something that might entertain you and help the foundation, I couldn't say no because I'm such a supporter of the foundation's work. So you kind of get me as a parasite, and I will try not to abuse the privilege. And I've, between Rebecca being in the audience when I've spoken to humanist groups and me being in the audience when Rebecca has spoken to humanist groups and secular and free thinker groups, we've been to them all. And this one by far has the best songs. So Tom Lehrer... Tom Lehrer once said about the Spanish Civil War, they won all the battles, but we had the best songs. But let's hope, in this case, they have the best songs and they win the battles. So hooray for the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I'm in the middle of a publicity tour for the Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And I will be giving the spiel from that book so many times that tonight I'm going to take the opportunity not to rehash the message of the book, but rather to explore its connections to the themes that concern all of us here, namely religion. So let me just say a couple of words about what the book is about. It's about a little appreciated fact that violence at scales large and small has been in decline for thousands of years, and we may be living in the most peaceful era of our species' existence. Now, this hasn't been a smooth decline, to put it mildly. It hasn't brought violence down to zero, and it isn't guaranteed to continue, but it is a phenomenon that can be documented on scales from millennia to years, from world wars and genocides to the spanking of children and the treatment of animals. It can be seen in the first major transition in human history, namely from the small-scale anarchic bands and tribes in which our species spent most of its evolutionary history, to the first settled states with cities and governments, which resulted in as we can best estimate from both from forensic evidence from prehistoric skeletons and estimates of rates of death in tribal warfare from recent hunter-gatherers, probably resulted in about a five-fold decrease in rate of violent death. That is about 15% of people in hunter-gatherer tribes die at the hands of their of other hunter-gatherers, and the figure is closer to 3% in the earliest states. There was a subsequent decline in the transition from medieval times to modernity, at least in Europe, where homicide statistics go back for, in some places, 7 or 8 centuries, a decline by a further factor of about 35. Medieval Englishman had about a 35 times greater chance of being murdered than a contemporary Englishman. Another major transition in human history has been the due to the humanitarian reforms around the time of the Enlightenment, the abolition of what our Constitution calls cruel and unusual punishments, although they actually weren't so unusual in those days, but they were plenty cruel. Punishments such as breaking on the wheel, burning at the stake, disemboweling, impalement, mutilation, often for heresy, blasphemy, unconventional sexual practices, criticizing the royal garden, robbing a rabbit warren, and so on. And so the Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, it was actually part of a movement, and the United States was actually in the middle of a pack of abolitions of punitive torture that were concentrated in the second half of the 18th century, that remarkable slice of human history. Also during this humanitarian revolution, as it's sometimes been called, there was or plus or minus 50 years, the world, at least parts of the world, saw the abolition of slavery, of debt bondage, of blood sports, of persecution of religious heresy, of execution for frivolous reasons. In the 17th century, England had 222 capital crimes, including stealing cabbages and signs of moral turpitude in a child 7 to 14 years of age. By the 19th century, those had been whittled down to four. In the United States, a majority of executions in colonial times and in the early years of the Republic were for nonviolent crimes like concealing birth and counterfeiting, even though the United States is an outlier compared to other Western democracies in still having the death penalty, and even then only in two-thirds of the states, it's a shadow of its former self, and we execute people at a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the rate at which our ancestors did in the early years of the country. Now, another transition that is seldom appreciated is the what some historians call the long peace, the remarkable fact that since 1945, the developed states, rich countries, have stopped going to war with each other. We take it for granted that war is something that happens in poor parts of the world, but any student of European history knows that that was not always true, that it was the powerful, rich, most developed states at their time of their times that often were at each other's throats. That suddenly ended after World War II, and most dramatically, the two biggest superpowers, the U.S. and the USSR, contrary to all predictions, never fought a war directly with each other. This long peace, one might say, well, what's so great about that if they're still fighting wars in the Southern Hemisphere and in poorer parts of the world? Well, it took a while, but the idea that peace is better than war is spreading to the rest of the world as well. And it's a little known fact that since the end of the Cold War in around 1990, there has been a plummeting of the number of wars and the rate of death in war all over the world. And so the dreams of the 1960s folk singers are almost coming true. The world is almost putting an end to war. Just to give you some numbers, in during the peak years of World War II, the worldwide rate of death in war was about 300 per 100,000 per year. In the late 40s and early 50s, it was about 20 to 25. Now it is less than 3/10 of one person per 100,000 per year. So your randomly selected person on Earth is almost certainly not going to die of violence, and that is a remarkable development in human affairs. Well, what does this have to do? Oh, and finally, final transition are the various rights revolutions of the post-war period, the Civil Rights Revolution, the Women's Rights Revolution, the revolution in gay rights, children's rights, extending now to animal rights, which has resulted in measurable reductions in lynchings, hate crimes, rape, spousal abuse, spousal homicide, child abuse, spanking, corporal punishment, meat eating, hunting, and laws that criminalize homosexuality. So what does this have to do with religion? Well, I've get a lot of questions, and some of them are frequently asked. And one of them is, hasn't religion been responsible for a lot of the violence in human history? Coming from the other side, I often get the question, hasn't the decline of violence been pushed along by religion, most often Christianity, and haven't the horrors of the 20th century been due to the rise of secularism and the rejection of God? Those are two frequently asked questions. Well, The Better Angels of Our Nature is a book about numbers. It has 100 graphs, and whenever it comes to questions like, was the 20th century the worst in history, or how bad was religion in human affairs, I try to find some expert somewhere who has actually gathered the numbers, the various, as they call themselves, atrocitologists and necrometricians, of which my favorite is Matthew White, who has a book coming out called The Great Big Book of Horrible Things, which... a book that I recommend highly. It's coming out in November, in which he lists the 100 worst things that people have done to each other that we know of. And he says in a footnote to the book, a friend of mine once asked me, I wonder what percentage of the world's suffering has been caused by religion. and he said 11%. He calculated the death toll from all causes such as greed, exploitation, decaying emperors, megalomaniac conquerors, and so on. And about 47 million deaths over the course of history can be attributed to religion. Now, of course, defenders of religion could say, well, we're only responsible for 10% of the world's mass murders. But given the pretensions of religion to actually be a force for peace, even to have caused 10% needs a little bit of explaining. And in fact, it's not hard looking through the 100 worst things that people have ever done to each other to see a number of religious multicides, as White calls them, such as, well, if we allow our imaginations to take the events narrated in the Bible, if not literally true, but as recording common practices of the time, then of course the Old Testament has one genocide after another, where God commands the Israelites either to massacre every last man, woman, and child, or sometimes to leave alive the attractive young women so they could rape them and take them as wives. The New Testament valorizes what is probably the most benighted form of human violence, namely human sacrifice, a practice that was exercised with relish by all of the first states and civilizations, who would often massacre people by the thousands after a prolonged period of torture in order to placate gods. If the theory of causation was that the world is full of nasty surprises, there are wars and pestilence and famine, what kind of a god would create a world like that? Well, it must be a bloodthirsty god. Maybe if we placate him by killing some people proactively, then we'll save ourselves from being his next victim. Well, the practice of human sacrifice did die out in most civilizations, but it's interesting that it was, in particular in Judaism, of course, was founded in large part on the rejection of human sacrifice. The story of the binding of Isaac is an example of how it was a move just barely away from it. There was just the sacrifice of goats and sheep instead of children. But the ideal of human sacrifice did survive in one of the breakaway sects of Judaism called Christianity, in which the basis of the religion is that the most wonderful event in human history, the good news, was a case of human sacrifice, where an innocent man was tortured to death in order that God not visit a worse fate on the rest of humanity. Now, in the subsequent centuries, we've seen things like, by the way, whenever anyone complains about violent entertainment today, the video games, the Hollywood splatter flicks, I've looked at some histories of violent entertainment, and by far the most revolting, the most prurient form of violent entertainment, where women are mutilated, a lot of the violence directed against erogenous zones, men are tortured in the most grisly, ingenious, sick ways. You just look at the lives of the saints, the hagiographies. And anytime you see a street named after St. Catherine, St. George, the way they died is just not to be believed. And these were described in pornographic relish in the early hagiographies. Well, in moving now from what got valorized to what actually happened, we have events like the Crusades, which are estimated to have resulted in the massacre of some million people, mostly Jews and Muslims. And considering that the world's population at the time was a sixth of what it was in the middle of the 20th century, that works out to a kind of prorated per capita rate of about 6 million, a number that has a rather chilling modern resonance. The European wars of religion, such as the 80 Years' War, the English Civil War, the 30 Years' War, the French Huguenot Wars, were among the bloodiest events in history. And the 30 Years' War alone in Germany resulted in a death rate that, again, adjusted for the world's population at the time, was greater than the death rate in World War I and approaching that of World War II in Europe. Then there was the annihilation of Native peoples, especially Native Americans, who were often given the choice to convert or be killed. Sometimes the choice was recited to them in Latin, and for some strange reason, they just did not see the light. And a number of genocides were justified by the fact that these are people who were offered the choice and refused it, therefore they deserve their fate. One example, rather uncomfortably close to home, is that when the Pequot Indians in New England were exterminated, the minister Increase Mather offered a prayer for that, thanking God for sending 600 heathen souls to hell. Now, this did not hurt his career. He later went on to become the president of Harvard University. Many faculty at Harvard are affiliated with a residential house. The one that I'm affiliated with is Mather House. And I asked the master of Mather House whether it was named after Cotton or Increase, and she said, "Oh, absolutely Increase, because our motto is Increase Mather's Spirit." This was the man who thanked God for genocide. Another way in which the role of religion is not a pretty picture in the history that I try to document is that all of those humanitarian reforms that I have attributed to the Enlightenment, the abolition of torture and slavery and so on, many of them were vigorously opposed by the Catholic Church of the time. For example, one of the most important liberating books of human history, Cesare Beccaria's On Crime and Punishment, which laid out a meticulous case against the use of gruesome torture as a form of criminal punishment, and which laid out the foundations of the criminal justice system that we have today. Namely, the punishment should be proportional to the crime, not because there's some cosmic scale of justice that has to be balanced, but just working out the incentive structure. If you have a severe punishment for a minor crime, well, anyone who commits a minor crime is going to figure, well, I may as well commit a major crime. I'm going to get punished the same anyway. And so that's why you calibrate the punishments to the level of the crime. Anyway, he argued that instead of having horrific punishments that are meted out capriciously, if what you really want to do in a criminal justice system is not just to inflict pain, but rather to set up a set of deterrents that will reduce the aggregate amount of crime, then it's much better to have small, reliable punishments than horrific, unpredictable ones. Anyway, his book was placed on the papal index. It would be misleading to blame history's atrocities on religion. They were only responsible for about 10% of the deaths. The question is, why even those 10%, given that with the claims of religion to embody moral progress, you'd think they'd be saving 10% of the lives, not causing them. Well, there are a number of features, I think, of militant religions that have led to some of this grisly history. One of them is simply the perpetuation of superstition. If you believe that there is a bloodthirsty God whose thirst for blood must be regularly slaked, if you believe that Jews killed Jesus, if you believe that children are possessed by the devil, which has to be beaten out of them, if you believe that God created a hierarchy of races, if you believe that God put animals on earth for humans' pleasure and that animals don't have souls, therefore they're incapable of suffering, if you believe that homosexuality is part of a morally degenerate lifestyle, all of these license various forms of punishment, punitive violence. As Voltaire said, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. There's also a problem that militant religions tend to share with non-religious ideologies that go into the other 90% of human atrocities, and that is a belief system that, first of all, is demonizing, that is, singles out some class of people as the obstacles to a perfect world. In the case of militant religions, it's the heretics or the infidels or the non-believers. In the case of the Nazis, it was the inferior races. In the case of communism, it was the upper classes. And a second toxic aspect to these ideologies is a belief in utopia. Now, one might think that who could be against utopia? Granted, it may not be practical. There are all kinds of reasons why you may not be able to get to infinite good, but shouldn't our reach exceed our grasp? Wouldn't 10% of a perfect world be better than what we have now? Well, the answer, I think, is no, and for two reasons. One of them is, if you have a belief system that holds out the prospect of infinite good, well, then you can commit arbitrary amounts of violence in pursuit of this infinitely good world, and you're still ahead of the game. The benefits exceed the costs. The ends justify the means. Also, if you are absolutely convinced that you have the formula for obtaining infinite good forever, and there are people who learn about your plan and they just don't buy it, they oppose it. Well, how evil are they if they are the main obstacle to an infinitely good world? Well, they're arbitrarily evil and deserving of arbitrary punishment, and the scales of justice will be balanced. So that's why the demonizing utopian ideologies account for some of the largest death tolls among in the history of human atrocity. It's a common meme that has been circulating among people who've responded to the new atheism and who defend religion as a source of morality is that the atheistic regimes of the 20th century killed far more people than religions. Well, and that's probably true. It's probably something like 70 to 80 million people killed by communist regimes compared to only 40 or so million by religions. Maybe that's something to be proud of. But one could argue that it isn't something to be proud of. But I think it actually just states the contrast in a highly propagandistic and misleading way. Because, of course, for one thing, Nazism was not an atheist movement to begin with. Hitler was not an atheist, and a lot of the top Nazi leaders were believers. And in fact, there was a movement of kind of syncretic German religion that arose that merged Nazism and Christianity, as documented in books like The Holy Reich. But in any case, both Nazism and communism didn't define their ideology by the rejection of God. They defined it by the various other notions of class conflict and race conflict and so on. It's only a religious mindset that divides the world into those that believe in the Judeo-Christian God and those that don't, that even divide up political systems that way. It would be just as sensible to divide up political systems into those that are Zoroastrian and those that aren't, or those that believe in the in Hinduism and those that don't. I think there is a clear divide among the toxic and the benevolent belief systems. And that's the one that, on the one hand, posits utopias and invents demons that stand in the way of utopias. Not all of those movements are religious. Some of them are, and some of them that aren't are just as or even more pernicious. As opposed to the tradition that has grown out of the Enlightenment with roots going back to ancient Greece, that what you could call classical liberalism or Enlightenment humanism or secular humanism. And this idea gave me something of a coherent narrative for the historical trends that I document. Namely, it does seem kind of spooky that so many trends seem to be pushing in the same direction. Why, at the same time as developed states stopped waging war with each other, did countries all over the world decriminalize homosexuality? or stop spanking children. You could imagine that some trends would go in one direction, some trends would go in another direction. Why does there seem to be this arrow pointing away from violence in the course of human history? It seems spooky, and it seems to some people as a kind of vindication that there must be a divine purpose. But given the actual history of divine plans being carried out, at least as interpreted by human defenders, one can question that as an explanation for why the world has been moving away from violence. I think the narrative, and it's fitting that I will be that I am the warm-up act for Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, because this is the contribution that she made to the book as a student of analytic philosophy, of modern Western philosophy, of Spinoza in particular, but also David Hume and Bertrand Russell, that there actually is a coherent morality that comes out of a commitment to rationality and objectivity. And it's not a coincidence that all of these trends move in the same direction, Rebecca has convinced me, because as you start to think about the way the world works, make sense of the word ought, what ought we to do, how ought we to arrange our affairs, there's something about the nature of logic and reality that's going to push you in that direction. Namely, as soon as you are part of a community of rational agents interacting with one another, you can no longer say that my needs, my goals, my interests are special just because I'm me and you're not. And therefore you, at least not if you want anyone else to take you seriously in this rational debate that you're having. And so many of the exploitative rationales for violence, for rape, for colonial conquest, for torture, for the for entertainment, for war insensitive to its human costs, start to evaporate or wither as the more and more society organizes itself along rational lines. So that's the great arrow in the sky that seems to be pointing peaceward, is the arrow of where rationality will take you. Now, I'm not a philosopher. I got my philosophy from Rebecca. I'm I'm a social scientist, so I look for cause and effect in the empirical world. And so the question is, given that in an ideal world of rational agents that you would expect there to be less and less violence, how is it that our miserable species has been able to see this arrow and become more collectively rational? And I think there have been material and cultural changes that have allowed humans to better approximate the rational ideal. Things like universal literacy, freedom of speech and assembly, freedom of movement, cosmopolitan mixing of populations, increases in education, all of which haltingly, noisily, slowly, with lots of local reversals, and certainly not everywhere on the globe, get people to reason their way out of hogwash, to see the follies of the tribalism and deference to authority and puritanism that probably are part of human nature. Over time, as these rational faculties become honed in the crucible of debate and free speech, more and more of the world realizes that nonviolence is really a more rational way to organize our affairs. And so with this acknowledgement to our honoree and next speaker, I will have summed up the main coherent narrative that organizes this vast, messy history that I've tried to make sense of in The Better Angels of Our Nature. Thank you very much.